As we started our studies of chapter 11 in Romans, we saw that God's shift in both focus of his message and focus of his audience does not mean that he has decided to have nothing more to do with Israel, because at the end of chapter 10, the last verse was that God had said about Israel, "All day long I've stretched out my hands to a disobedient," which technically is an unpersuaded and argumentative people. And I don't suppose there's anything worse than an unpersuaded argumentative person. He said that, and then Paul just automatically assumed that some of his readers would assume from that, because it's a human thing to do, that meant that God was up to here with all of this and he was done with these people. And in some respects, there's truth in that, in the sense that on the individual level, there is such a thing as God coming to the end of his grace toward a person who is obstinate and rebellious. He does. He says, "I'm done with this." If that person is one of his children, that typically means the person's going to die. If they're not one of his children and he's been addressing them in the truth, then that means he'll stop addressing them and let's let them go. The issue, however, here is that Israel as a national entity had been given certain commitments, certain promises that God had made to both the national entity and certain individuals within it. And the fact that God has decided to shift his focus of message from justice to grace and his audience from Israel as a nation to this non-national group that's going to be made up of inhabitants of all the nations, and yet he's going to turn them into a kind of a nation that's not of this world. That does not mean that he's going to dispense with his promises, but it does mean that he has a larger plan that includes more than what those earlier promises actually revealed. Though there are hints and suggestions, because Paul is constantly referring to texts in the Old Testament that say, well, now, he did say this, and this is a part of this bigger picture, and even though Paul would be the first to admit that the church and its existence and his plans for the church and all that was a mystery that was unrevealed in the Old Testament, the fact that God had a bigger plan than just Israel in mind is revealed in the Old Testament. And so we've seen a little bit of that. There were certain indicators within the Old Testament scriptures that were given during the time when his focus was on the nation. There were certain indicators that he had a larger plan in mind, and Paul presented some of those indicators, starting with the words of Moses in Deuteronomy 31:29 through 32:21, where he said, Moses said to the nation of Israel and the people of it, that I know that after I die, you guys are going to just get, you know, apostate, you're going to turn to other nations, you're going to be hard-headed because you're a stiff-necked and rebellious people. And remember, there are some in there that doesn't apply to, like Joshua and some of the rest. But nonetheless, he was saying, this is the way it's going to work. I know you people. This way you're going to act. And in the words of that context, he argued that he was going to bring Israel to a totally different heart and mind attitude through a process of making them jealous by a non-people, a non-nation, kind of a God's going to turn to the dregs of the world in order to make you jealous, because he was willing to give you all of the benefits and all of the good things that his focus of attention on you would have brought if you'd have been willing to be persuaded and not so argumentative. But the very fact that he's going to use these others to make you jealous to bring you back to him means he hasn't given up on them. And then he also in Isaiah 65 verses 1 and 2 had said something along the same kind of line. But the issue is that these verses that he quotes out of Moses and Isaiah, they were indicators that God had a bigger picture in mind, but nobody really knew that those verses were so significant that they were to be taken to indicate events that would last for a couple thousand years. I mean, who knew that this process of using a non-people to make Israel jealous was going to actually take 2,000 years to come to pass? Who knew? And the idea that in the text that he quoted, all the day long I stretched out my hands to a disobedient or unpersuaded and argumentative people, who knew that that was just a kind of an open wedge in the doorway that wasn't developed? I mean, you don't read about the church in the Old Testament. You don't read about the whole economy of God building a church for his son over a period of long centuries. None of that's there, but there are these indicators. And then, having pointed out that God actually declared that his larger plan included doing some pretty remarkable things in order to salvage Israel from the deep bondage of their depravity, Paul immediately forced a primary error into the spotlight, and that error involved the false conclusion that such a major shift in message and audience signaled a permanent turn by God away from Israel because of their persistent depravity. And that spotlight consisted of this question that's raised here in chapter 11. Has God turned away, pushed aside all the plans that he had revealed regarding his commitments of blessing upon Israel? Does this mean that he, in his expression of his shift of focus off of them as a disciplinary action, mean that he's done with them? And of course, like I said a couple weeks ago, the natural attitude of human beings is, yeah, if God's fed up with you, you're done with. Well, that's absolutely contrary to what Paul argued in chapter 10. Chapter 10 says he's not done with them. He's going to make them jealous to bring them back. So Paul's just assuming that his readers are like most readers. They just don't, you know, it's kind of like Jesus saying, I'm going up to Jerusalem, I'm going to be put to death, and in 3 days I'll rise again. Well, they got the death thing, and they just ignored that rise again stuff because it was too far out of their radar. So the whole point here is, in our last study, Paul's answer was an emphatic no. God has not set aside his people. We saw that he argued on the basis of his own identity as both the physical seed of Abraham and an heir of the faith of Abraham, because that's part of his argument in Romans 4, particularly verse 12, where he says, the seed of Abraham has a twofold requirement. You have to be genetically connected, and you have to believe like he did, so that God is God of the Gentiles in the uncircumcision of Abraham, because they believe like Abraham, but he's also the God of the circumcision who, in addition to circumcision, believe like Abraham. So this whole issue of being a child of Abraham and therefore an heir of the promises, and he's arguing, yeah, I'm one of them, and that proves that God hadn't cast off his people. The whole thing there is that you have to understand what he was teaching back in Romans 9 about there being an Israel within Israel, that there is a national entity that's known as Israel, but all of those people in there are not true Israel, because their only real connection to Israel is the genetic connection, and there's no follow-up in faith. They don't believe God. They don't trust him. They don't want him in their lives and all that kind of thing. So, the thing about believing God is that once you do, then God can't possibly thrust away those who have believed his promises. He becomes a liar. And he's not going to do that. And Paul's argument in Romans 11, when it says in verse 2, at the first of the verse, God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. What he's really doing here is he's talking about God's integrity in respect to a group of people to whom he's made promises. They have believed them. They are foreknown in that regard as a group that he has had knowledge of from way, way back. In fact, the way, way back goes all the way back to creation, because Revelation 17:9 says that God has written the names of the elect from the foundation of the world. So there's an intimacy of naming before they ever came into historical existence. And in the eternality of God and in this whole business of him creating time and him living outside of time and somehow working with us in time, that's all a big, huge mystery. But the fact is, there are some people that he has foreknown, and they have believed him, and he is not going to turn his back on them. And Paul says, I'm one of them. Even though Paul would have argued, and he's going to argue in this text, it's not, well, we won't get into it this evening, but it's not because Paul had a special godly character. I mean, we all know Paul's story. He's the chief of sinners, and yet God saves him in order to make manifest how willing he is to extend grace to those who are willing to trust him regardless of what they've done. So the whole point there is that Paul is arguing that God has not rejected the people whom he foreknew. And in a relational universe that's rooted in immutable integrity, it only takes one person to believe what God has promised to put him on the hook to fulfill it. And you don't have to be a person with a lot of faith, because Jesus taught, no, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, God will do what he has said he will do to you, for you, or however the promise was made. So in human thinking, we tend always to go with this idea that I must have done something good for this kind of thing to happen to me. But the fact is, no, you must not have. That's not the issue. The whole point here is, in the study this evening, we're going to look at what he asks in verse 2. Don't you know about that passage of Scripture about Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they've killed your prophets and they've torn down your altars. I alone am left and they're seeking my life. And what's the divine response? I've kept 7,000 for myself, men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. We're going to be looking at that question. Don't you know the significance of that scripture that says this stuff? Because if it only takes one to believe him to put him on the hook for fulfillment, what happens if 7,000 believe him? Well, then, you know, he's got to do it. He's got to do it. He can't just decide, because the vast majority of these stiff-necked, rebellious, disobedient, argumentative people are like they are. And he said, I've held out my hands to them all day long, and they refuse to return, or they refuse to respond. Just because they're that way doesn't mean that he's free to ignore those that don't fit that category, because they have believed him. You can't just say, I'm done with you. What happens to all those promises he made? The fact that there are 7,000 that believed even during the darker days of Israel's apostasy more than necessitates God's active pursuit of the promises he made to Abraham, who believed him, to Moses, who believed him, to David, who believed him, to Jeremiah and Ezekiel, who believed him. He made promises to people that believed him. Therefore, he can't just say, all right, we're going to change this whole thing. Forget all that I said. Let's look at the text this evening in verse 2 and following. I call this Paul's appeal to 1 Kings 19, verses 14 through 18. According to verse 2, he says, don't you know what the scripture says in that passage about Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel? Well, that's the record of 1 Kings 19. But I want us to start with the reality of, don't you know what the scripture says in that passage about? In other words, if it's written in the scriptures, it's settled. You remember in Habakkuk, when Habakkuk was complaining to God about how all these inhabitants of Judea were just as bad as Israel, they were just as apostate, he said, I cry out to violence and you don't hear. And he was just really complaining, Habakkuk was. And then God said, well, I'm going to respond. I'm going to do something that you won't believe even if I tell you. And then he told him, I'm going to send Babylon in on Judea. And when they come, it's going to be a slaughter. And all of a sudden, Habakkuk on the other side said, oh, you can't do that, God. They're worse than we are. You can't look on evil and nah. And you know what God's response is? Write it down. If it's written down, it's going to happen. And the reverse of that is shown in a passage in Revelation 10, because in the book of Revelation you have these seal judgments, and you have these trumpet judgments, you have these bowl judgments, and then there are these thunder judgments that are mentioned in Revelation 10, seven thunders utter their voices, and then a voice from heaven verse 4, I believe it is, says, shut up what the thunders ordered and don't write that down. What does that mean? Well, it's not going to happen. So this whole business of don't you know what the scriptures say is an indication that if it's written down, we not only need to know what it says, but we need to believe that he meant that. This is the foundation for our understanding of his appeal to this passage in 1 Kings 19. This is a passage that addresses this whole question that has roiled the R-O-I-L-D, the community of believers in our generations, because we have, ever since the Reformation, had an entrenched theological notion that God had set the nation of Israel aside and had no more future for them. And this was entrenched way before the Reformation because it was a part of Roman Catholic theology. And Roman Catholics felt justified in being extremely hateful to Jews because they were the murderers of the Christ. And they had no idea what Paul meant when he said, in respect to the gospel, they're your enemies, but in respect to God's plan, they're not. So you need to keep that kind of in balance. Well, the Roman Catholic Church never tried to keep anything in balance, but nonetheless, the idea was entrenched by the time Martin Luther and Calvin and all those guys came on the scene. And there were just huge pieces of corrupt theology that they never shed, simply because they didn't have the opportunity and time. They were brought to a new realization of justification by grace through faith, and that became the foundational doctrine of the Reformation, and it became the thing that they harped on week after week after week. And when I say harped on it, there's a sense in which if people's instruction for years and even centuries has been along one line, if you're going to change that, you got to do a lot of harping. You got to stay on this thing and stay on it and stay on it and stay on it and stay on it. The problem with staying on a given error in trying to correct it is that you don't ever preach all that other stuff. And if you don't ever preach all that other stuff, people don't ever come to grips with all that other stuff. So you had concepts that were carried over into the Reformation where they had these debates about whether the body of Jesus was actually transformed from the bread was actually transformed into his actual body, and the cup was the blood, the wine in the cup was actually transformed into his actual blood. You had all that kind of stuff that they just brought along with them. And then you still had this baptism of infants and all kinds of stuff, including a huge amount of legalism. They got rid of the legalism in terms of justification by grace through faith, but they never got rid of the legalism that went beyond justification. And so there's just a whole lot of stuff. And so we have these centuries of this idea that God rejected Israel and he's done with them. And no, what you need to do with the promises that he made to Israel is realize that he's fulfilling those in a spiritual sense to the church. Well, how do you spiritually realize God's promises to Abraham and David and Ezekiel and Jeremiah when he talks about if the stars and the moon and the sun cease to be, then maybe my promise to keep this nation together forever will be subject to reevaluation. How do you spiritualize that? When we look at 1 Kings 19, and this, it says when he pleads with God against Israel, that's a better, far better translation than the King James, which says he intercedes with God against Israel. The word intercedes is the way this verb is actually mostly translated. It's only used about four or five times in the New Testament. This is the only time it's pleads with God against Israel. But intercede has too much of a connotation of seeking blessing for someone. You never talk about interceding for somebody for their destruction. We were listening to Dr. Easley, former president of Moody, today on our way over, and he said, I really enjoy reading the Psalms as a part of my devotional life. He said, I particularly like the imprecatory Psalms. God, kill my enemies. Well, the whole point there is, the pleading with God against Israel is actually a pleading against Israel so that God will do something to them for their obstinance and all that kind of thing. Because what does he say? Verse 3. They killed your prophets. They've torn down your altars. And I'm the only one left and they're trying to kill me. So this is not an appeal to God to have mercy and, you know, bring blessing into their lives and all that kind of thing. He's got quite an indictment against them. And one of the things that this appeal indicates is that even when an extremely loyal believer like Elijah, even when he gets it wrong, and he's a prophet and he's got it wrong, and he seeks a false result from God, God is going to maintain his integrity. So that integrity is going to continue to dominate. God didn't say, okay, Elijah, I hear you. You got a point. I'll kill them all for you. He didn't do that. He said, wait a minute. And then he points out Elijah's false conclusions as an argument for, you need to probably reevaluate what you're saying here and what you want me to do to these bad people. Now let's put this thing in its setting. 1 Kings 19 is a record of what has just, it's just after what had just come off at Mount Carmel. Elijah had called 450 prophets of Baal and another 350 or so false prophets, because I think there were 900 of them all together. Anyway, he had called them all together with a challenge. And he told the people that came along too, he said, you guys need to make up your mind who God is. If Baal is God, then you need to serve him. But if Yahweh is God, then you need to stop serving Baal and recognize that Yahweh is God. And he said, in order to facilitate this, I've got a challenge for all these 450 plus the other. I'm going to let you guys call on your God to come down, you know, to send fire down from heaven, consume a sacrifice. So build up your altar and put your sacrifice on it and call on God to receive your sacrifice. And so they, you know the story. But the point is, it didn't work. So after Elijah got a few, what I call, justified digs in. Oh, maybe he's going on vacation. He's asleep. He doesn't. Whatever. Then he soaks his sacrifice 7 times, I believe it is, with water until the water's running all over everywhere. And then he just steps back and calls on Yahweh to prove that he's God. And fire falls from heaven and consumes not only the sacrifice, but the stones of the altar and licks up all the water and the ground dry as dust when he's all done. And the people say, Yahweh is Lord. Well, you would think that that would be encouraging to Elijah. He actually took them at their word at that point and commanded them to bring all these prophets down so that he could execute them. He killed all of them. Elijah was no mealy mouth, you know. He was a violent opposer of those who opposed God, and he proved it. He killed them all. Well, the people had to go along with that. I mean, what were they going to say? Hey, wait. We know Yahweh's God, but we know these prophets, they're friends of ours. We don't want them killed. No. They have led you astray. They have perverted the truth. They have despised the true God of heaven, and they're dead. And so he killed them all. Well, that was on the heels, or that was just before then, he told his helper to go see if there was a cloud in the sky anywhere, and that's when he started praying for rain, because you remember the prophet had said, it's not going to rain by my word. And in the law of Moses, it had said, if you don't believe that I am the true God, then I'm going to shut up heaven like brass and it's not going to rain. So in effect, Elijah was just saying, God's not going to send you any rain until you acknowledge who he is. And since they acknowledged it at that event, he began to pray for rain, and then came this thunderstorm or deluge. He told Ahab, get in your chariot and get out of here, because there's going to be so much water that your chariot's going to bog down the mud if you don't get with it. And then he ran along with the chariot to Jezreel. That's where Jezebel was. And the king went in and told his wife, you know what Elijah did? He killed every one of those prophets that we've been feeding all this time. All of them. And she said, well, then I'm going to get him. So she sent a message to him, and to Elijah, and said, you know, tomorrow at this time, you're going to be just like those people you killed. Made this big threat. Well, Elijah decided that Jezreel was not a safe place to be, so he took off and he ran and he ran and he ran until he was exhausted. And then he was fed by some ravens and he was given food to eat and drink. And then you have this amazing statement that he fed on this food, rested, fed again, and in the strength of that food ran all the way from where he was to Mount Horeb down in the Sinai Peninsula. 40 days and 40 nights. It's amazing. You know, you talk about a marathon. Well, he got down there and then he really was exhausted. And this is where this conversation with God comes from, because God asks him, what are you doing down here? And then he goes into this deep despairing, well, you know how they are. I've been very jealous of Yahweh, God of hosts, but Israel's so forsaken Yahweh that I'm the only one left and they want to kill me. And by the way, he said that twice. He said that in 1 Kings 19:10, and then he repeated himself a little bit later in the text. You know, it doesn't take a scientist to recognize that he didn't really want to die, or he'd just let the queen do it for him. But he wants God to take his life. I'm just fed up. I don't want to be here anymore. I want out of here. Well, if you want out of here, what are you doing down here? She'd have done it. Well, anyway. Well, they've killed your prophets. What does that mean? They have tried to silence your words. They don't want to hear from you. They won't want to know anything about you. Anybody who tries to tell them anything that's true about you, they kill. Not only that, but the word that's translated digged in the King James or torn down, that actually is used in one of the New Testament texts. It's a word that's not used very often, but it actually means they've reduced your altars to rubble. They weren't satisfied in knocking them over or whatever. They had to split all the stones apart, turn them all into just plain old rubble, so that there wouldn't be any indication that anybody had ever been willing to worship Yahweh. And then he said, they're trying to kill me and I'm the only one left. In addition to that, though Elijah doesn't say it, I really believe that what Elijah was operating on was this that he said in his, to himself, what just happened at Carmel isn't going to change them in any significant way. This is a hopeless case. And I am part of it. So I just want to die. And that's where this whole conversation gets in, is into it. So what does God say back to him in verse 4 of Romans 11? He says, I've kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. In other words, no, Elijah, you're wrong. You're not the only one left. There are 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Now, you have to keep in mind the historical setting here, because this is in Israel, not Judah. This is after the kingdoms have split, and Israel has never had a good king, and the people have been restrained by the king of Israel from going down to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh. So they've built their own temple, and they've built their own altars, and they've basically the kings have kept the people from going down into Jerusalem to worship because they know if the people are allowed to go down there year after year, after a while, they'll want to get back as a part of Judah. And then I won't be able to be the king anymore. So they ain't happy. Well, for God to say, I have kept 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. He's talking about 7,000 Israelites, not inhabitants of Judea. There are some people in Israel who are still believing, even after all that's gone on and after all of the opposition that's been foisted on them. And God says they're not doing this because of something in them. They're doing this because of something in me. I have kept them. And the whole point here is that this reserving 7,000 male adults who have not bowed a knee to Baal is the original sound of which Isaiah 1:9 is an echo. The original sound is, I have kept this apostasy from being 100%. I have done this. Isaiah 1:9 says, Isaiah says, except the Lord of hosts had preserved for us a remnant, we would have been like Sodom and Gomorrah. And what he's saying is, if God hadn't taken some kind of actions, our downward spiral into depravity would have brought us to the point that we were as morally corrupt as Sodom and Gomorrah, where God couldn't even find 10 people who believed him. So here's the whole thing is, God says, no, this is not about your argument that they deserve to all be killed or whatever because they're all disloyal. So that's not true, because I've made it not true. I've taken actions to keep it from being true. And that echo in Isaiah 1:9 is actually an echo that Paul appealed back to back in Romans chapter 9, verse 29. Except the Lord of Sabaoth had left to us a posterity, we would have become a Sodom and would have resembled Gomorrah. And his whole point there is that God is going to execute his word upon the earth. That's verse 28 of chapter 9. The Lord will execute his word. It's written. It's going to happen. And in order to make it happen, he has to do some things to validate his argument, his promises. His conclusion is, basically, that the current shift in God's focus of message from law to grace and his focus of attention on audience from Jews to Gentiles, and that shift was not exclusive. When the Holy Spirit descended at Pentecost, there were 16 language groups that were represented that heard the truth about God in their native language, but one of the languages that's listed is the language of the Hebrews. So Hebrew was one of them. So it's not like God's saying, no, I'm not talking to them anymore. He's just saying, no, they're not going to get the majority of my speech any longer. I'm not going to just focus on them. I'm going to focus on all these other language groups, and I'm going to draw out of them a whole bunch of people. The book of Revelation implies it's innumerable host that's going to come out of all these nations, kindreds, tongues, and so on. And Israel will be, there will be Israelites that are involved in that, but they're not going to be the main focus or even the majority focus for a while. The shift in a message and audience does not mean that God has negated his originally declared purpose. It's interesting that even those who see no future for Israel and God's plans recognize that there exist extensive promises to Israel that have to be addressed. And that's why they come up with this hermeneutical fantasy that you can just spiritualize these promises into something that has some spiritual sense but isn't real in terms of the actual words. They recognize the promises are there. Their argument is their promises will be fulfilled, but not in a normal sense of the language in terms of a real nation with a literal land and all that. It's not whether the promises will be addressed, it's how they're going to be addressed. And those who reject a future for Israel all address them by basically nullifying them. through what I call a spurious hermeneutic, where the obvious promises of eternal endurance are spiritualized out of existence. For example, David, who, if I understand the covenants properly, the Abrahamic covenant was the umbrella, and then you had the Palestinian covenant, which is the land promise, and then you had the Davidic covenant, which had to do with the seed promise, and then you had the new covenant, which had to do with the making you a father of many nations and that whole issue there. In 2 Samuel 7, we have the record of God coming to David to establish this seed covenant and reiterate it and drill down into it and give more details. And in 2 Samuel 7, which, by the way, is followed by what? 2 Samuel 13, the Bathsheba thing. So give your children enough security and they'll sin like the dickens. Not exactly. But nonetheless, it's in spite of human behavior. Paul's going to make that point next week in our study if we get back here next week. But the point is, in God's promise to David in 2 Samuel 7 includes this statement: I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more, neither will the children of wickedness afflict them any more. That's verse 10 of 2 Samuel 7. How do you spiritualize that? I'm going to give them a place. I'm going to plant them. They're going to dwell in the place of their own. They're not going to move anymore. And the children of wickedness won't afflict them anymore. And then he also says, and David, your house and your kingdom will be established forever before you. Your throne will be established forever. Now, admittedly, I mean, we already have the history of the judges, where the land promises were made, but the implication of the promise was the land's yours, but your ability to live in it and prosper from it is dependent on whether you'll be loyal to the covenant. And if you won't, then I'll send some people in and make sure that you wish you had. There is that, which does kind of interrupt the ownership of the land in terms of actual, not ownership, but the benefit of the land. Benefit requires belief. So when God promises David's throne will be established forever, he's not saying that there won't be any kind of interludes. I mean, he even told Jeconiah, who was the son of David along with the Solomonic lineage, if you were a ring, signet ring on my finger, I'd take it off and throw it away. You're not going to have any offspring on the throne of David from here on. Well, that effectively cut off the regnal line from Solomon. That's why it's the Nathanic line in the genealogy of Jesus in the New Testament that Jesus comes through. He doesn't come through Solomon. So there's those promises made to David. And then God promised Jeremiah in Jeremiah 31 that Israel and Judah would be brought back to a universal loyalty to Yahweh, verse 34, Jeremiah 31, forever. And that they will be a nation as long as the sun, moon, and stars exist. And that only if heaven can be measured will he cast Israel off. That's verse 37. So if he was going to cast off his people, you'd have to read somewhere that heaven had finally been measured. It was this many light years long and this many light years wide, and we know what in heaven. That's impossible to man, and therefore he says that's the only way I'll cast off Israel, is if heaven can be measured. So Paul's conclusion is the shift in focus and audience doesn't mean God's through with Israel, but it must be realized. According to the statement in verse 5, in the same way then, there has also come to be at this present time a remnant according to God's gracious choice, or literally, a remnant according to the election of grace. That's Paul's conclusion. He says, I'm one of these guys. I'm one of this election of grace. That proves that God isn't going to cast off his people. Just like there was a remnant in Elijah's day, 7,000 among several millions, not a big number, but 7,000 still a remnant. And just as there was then, there is now. And of course, there were a lot of Jews in the first century who had believed in Jesus as the Messiah, and therefore they became a part of this remnant issue. But the commitment is rooted in the grace of God, not in sustained loyalty. Until God fulfills His promise to Jeremiah and Ezekiel that He's going to put in the hearts of His people His law so that they will naturally do everything that's in His law and they will be His people and He will be their God. Until that happens, He isn't going to found any of His promises on their behavior. Because then He'd be putting His integrity in their hands and He isn't going to do that. One of the things that I want you to think about in the days to come, especially as we get into verse 6 and following, is this. Paul calls this an election according to grace. He says that the impact of that was these men didn't bow the knee to Baal. And that means that grace in some way prevented idolatry. It didn't overlook it. It didn't forgive it. It prevented it. These guys have not bowed the knee to Baal. Why? Because my grace is in operation here. So that I believe that Paul's perception of grace never did include the notion that it is some kind of impotent, merciful forgiveness thing that just doesn't really make any big dent. I just don't believe that. Paul didn't either, apparently. Because he said that God's grace kept these people from this apostasy that they were dwelling in the midst of. Think about that because we're going to be talking about it in the weeks to come.